Thank you, Dr. Bauer. Thank you for the invitation. I think my presentation is going to be completely different from all the presentations that you have seen so far. I'm going to talk to you about irrigation management in a regional context. The title of my presentation is going to be Remote Sensing for Crop Water Use Management, Present Status and Challenges. I would like to thank my co-authors, Dr. Jose Chavez, who is with the Colorado State University in Fort Collins, Colorado, Paul Colaizzi and Dr. Terry Howell, who are my colleagues in USTARS, Bushland, Texas. Here is the outline of my presentation. I'm going to introduce the topic first, and then I'm going to talk about the irrigation management in the US and its limitation in a regional context. Then I'm going to talk about remote sensing-based ET models that are being used in the last 10, 15 years. Then I'm going to discuss some of the challenges related to this field. Then in 2007 and 2008, we conducted two experiments in response to these challenges. I'm going to talk about that a little bit. Then I'll take some questions if there's some time. Most of you know very well that water is the most important but limited natural resources in the world. About 70% of all the world's freshwater resources are used for irrigating 18% of the cropland. However, this 18% actually produces more than 40% of the global food production. So as a result of this, the groundwater extraction for irrigation is increasing in arid and semi-arid regions of the world, especially in China and India, where groundwater extraction increased by almost 50% between 1975 and 2000. In addition, global climate change is affecting the availability of water in terms of timing and quantity in reference to agriculture. Here are some statistics for the US. These statistics are reported by the USGS in 2000. About 137 billion gallons of water is used for irrigation every day in the US. Out of that, 80 billion comes from surface water sources, and about 57 billion gallons of water comes from the groundwater resources. This is another graph that I extracted from the same report. As you can see, the population increased at a nominal rate between 1950 to 2000. But if you look at the irrigation withdrawal rate, it increased about 40% between 1950 to 1980s. After that, it kind of stabilized. I think that this is due to improvement in the crop varieties, drought-tolerant crops, improvements in the irrigation systems, and higher cost of fuels. But if you look at the population growth in the world, we had about 1 billion people in about 1800s, increased to 2.5 billion in 1950s, and then to 6 billion in 1999. We're expected to be between 7.3 to 10.7 billion by 2050. So the food production needs to be doubled in about 25 years to meet the population demand by the population, growing population. Nearly 60% of it has to come from the irrigated agriculture based on an FAO report. Okay, all these statistics calls for better management of water. And as you all know very well that ET is the major consumptive use of irrigation water and precipitation. Okay, I'm going to explain the present status of water management using the Texas High Plains as a case study. We have four large lysimeters in the bushland. We use these lysimeters to develop crop coefficients for all the major crops in the Texas High Plains. And then the Texas AgriLife Research and Extension has about 17 PET stations throughout the Texas Panhandle. And these stations report to a server on a daily basis and estimates grass reference CT and alfalfa reference CT. Using the crop coefficient and the reference CT, one can estimate the actual ET. So that's how farmers are doing their irrigation scheduling. At least we assume that they are doing it. So what is the problem with this system? I think the main problem is in the last 10 years, we're getting new varieties at least once every 2 years. So the crop coefficients that we developed on lysimeter fields are a lot more different from the one that we are growing today. So there are some numbers in Texas size plains. Based on that, they think that farmers are applying at least 10 to 20% more water than the required. The other problems with this approach is regional variation in crop coefficients. We develop crop coefficients based on the weather station data and lysimeter fields in bushland, and the same numbers are being used in southwest Kansas. But we don't really know that whether these numbers actually match well for southwest Kansas condition. Then other problems are funding constraints, like if there is a new crop coming into the region, then we need to develop a crop coefficient. That would take several years. Before we come up with a good crop coefficient, there may be some other crop, some other variety already in the picture. So it's going to be really tough to maintain that. Fortunately, in the last 10, 15 years, there are many developments in the remote sensing ETL algorithms, starting with Norman and Bill Kustas' work on two-source models and Wim Bastian's work on Siebel in Wageningen and Netherlands. There are two approaches that we can take using remote sensing to estimate crop water use. The first one is remote sensing-based crop coefficients, where people have attempted to replace crop coefficients with some kind of vegetation indices or replacing EAT units with vegetation indices to come up with the actual crop water use. And they're still in the initial stage. The second one is based on the surface energy balance model. This has four parameters. On the right-hand side, net radiation, ground heat flux, and sensible heat flux. If you can derive all three parameters from remote sensing, then one can estimate the ET number from it. Okay, further, we can classify these energy balance models into two categories. One is single source model. There are several models under this category: Siebel, Matrix, Surface Energy Balance System, Simplified Surface Energy Balance Model, and then SEBI, which is an index to estimate crop water use. The second one is the two source model, the two source energy balance model by Norman and Kustas. Basically, the main difference is remote sensing data is made of pixels. When you are trying to derive ET, in the single source model, we derive ET directly as a single component. But in the two source models, what they do is they try to calculate the percent cover within that pixel, and then they calculate the evaporation and transpiration separately, and then sum them together to come up with the ET numbers. So what are the advantages of using remote sensing for estimating actual ET? The very first one is you can have a map compared to a tabular information that you get from a PET network. By looking at this map, farmer can look at the spatial variability of wheat, and he can look at how that could affect the yield within his field, and then he can modify his irrigation strategies based on that. This is a picture of our experimental station. This is the lysimeter. There are four lysimeter fields. The lysimeters are located in the center of the each field. They are arranged in a black pattern. There are several other advantages. When you're using remote sensing for ET mapping, you don't need to know the crop type. All you need is a thermal image from a satellite. So that takes care of the main problem, which is releasing of new crop varieties every year. And the second thing is it captures the spatial variability. The farmers can look at their field and then see whether they are getting the same kind of ET throughout the field or if there is any variation, and they can always look at why it's happening. And the third one is the accuracy. It started with the development started about 15 years back. At that time, the accuracy was about 70%, and now it's a lot more improved. Some of the models actually gave up to 97% accuracy for a daily ET estimation. And it's cost effective. Most of the remote sensing data is free. It's downloadable from public websites, so you don't have to pay anything. The only the cost associated with it is somebody working on this data set and come up with an ET map. So usually it costs about $500 to $1,000 per scene to come up with an ET map. It also can be used to improve crop coefficient. For example, in high plains, we have crop coefficient developed in bushland, and you're using it in southwest Kansas. We can use this kind of data set to see whether the crop coefficient varies or it are the same. And in places where we don't have crop coefficients, especially in developing countries where managing a lice emitter or AD corn system is a very expensive proposition, they can use these methods to develop new crop coefficients. And also it can be a monitoring tool for groundwater districts to see whether all the producers are following their instructions or not. What are the challenges related to this approach? To develop a good ET map, what we need is a cloud-free remote sensing data. In places like Texas High Plains, getting a clear image is a very difficult thing to do. If you can get 4 or 5 good Landsat images throughout the growing season, that would be a good thing. But most of the time, we don't get that. The second challenge is, in order to use these ET maps for irrigation scheduling at a field level, we need high spatial resolution maps on a daily basis. Most of the high resolution satellites comes one in 8 days or one in 16 days over a given area. There are some satellites that comes every day, but they give us a spatial resolution of 1,000 meters, so we cannot use that. But fortunately, some of these satellites have thermal data at a sparse spatial resolution like 1,000 meter. At the same time, on the same sensor, they acquire visible and near-infrared images at a high resolution. So we are looking at combining those two images to see whether we can develop a high-resolution ET maps on a daily basis. And all these models are developed in different places, and we want to make sure that they work well when we are trying to use it in our area. So for that, we need to be evaluating these methods, and it's a very expensive proposition. We need to have lots of information to do that. In addition to that, we don't have lice meter fields everywhere. We use ease eddy coherence or bone ratio systems to do that, and most of you aware of the energy balance closure problems associated with these systems. Recently, in the last 5 years, there are some new systems coming into the market for estimation of ET, such as the scintillometer. But nobody there's not much research done on this system to make sure that these the estimates of ET from these systems are useful. The data accuracy. Most of these models uses hot and cold pixel within an image to estimate ET. They make an assumption that the hot pixel within an image has no ET, and then the cold pixel transferring at a maximum ET equivalent to a reference ET number. Then they assume that the ET in all the other pixels varies between this hot and cold pixel. So if you are wrong in selecting the hot and cold pixel, then you're going to be wrong in the estimation of ET. That's the biggest danger in there. And also there are several submodels that we need to use to estimate cover fraction, partial vegetation fraction, and leaf area index. So these are usually geographic specific models. So we need to be making sure that these models work if you are borrowing it from some other area, or we have to develop our own models to do this. The data processing time and user friendliness. Some of these models are very, very complicated, and it takes specialization to apply these methods to derive ET maps from remote sensing. And there are some attempts to automate these methods. Hopefully, they will be available within the next 2 to 3 years. It used to take about 1 to 3 weeks to download the satellite data to come up to develop ET maps. But nowadays, in the last, especially last 6 to 8 months, you can actually get this data set within a day, so that you can get these maps out very quickly. In order to address some of these challenges, we conducted two experiments during the summer of 2007 and 2008 in the USDARS Conservation and Production Research Laboratory located in Bushland, Texas, which is about 10 miles west of city of Amarillo. On the right side, it's an aerial picture of our lab, and these are the lysimeter fields where our four large lysimeters are located. As part of this experiment, we acquired remote sensing data with a spatial resolution of 50 centimeter to 250 meter in visible and near infrared, and 1.8 meter to 1,000 meter in thermal. What we wanted to do is we wanted to test the model to see these models work at every spatial resolution. It was a collaborative research project between USDARS lab in Bushland and Maricopa, Arizona, and two universities, University of Texas, Austin, and Utah State University. As part of that experiment, we collected crop growth information about 40 different locations covering all kinds of management practices, where we collected information on leaf area index, crop height, leaf width, all the crop growth information that we needed for running these models. So as part of this experiment, we got about 24 aircraft images, 6 Landsat images, and 2 Aster images. We repeated the experiment in 2008. This time we added one more goal to solve energy balance closure problem with AD coherence systems. For that, we had about 7 EC systems. The picture that you are seeing is a cross-calibration experiment right next to the winter wheat field before we use that in the BAREX experiment. This is some of the images that we acquired during 2007. These seven images are acquired using the aircraft sensor with a resolution of 50 centimeter. This one is an Aster image, and this is the Landsat. You can see the degradation of the image from aircraft to Landsat, the resolution changes. In fact, it gets worse when we use MODIS information, but we are conducting some research to see whether we can sharpen these images by combining near-infrared and visible data with thermal data. We also add the 3 scintillometers, one across the 2 irrigated field, one across 2 dry land, and one across one irrigated and one dry land lysimeter fields to see whether it really have a path weighting capability when it is estimating the ET. The way it works is it has a light source on one side and it has a receiver on the another side. When you send a light signal from the source, when it passes through the area above the canopy, because of the presence of eddies, what happens is there will be a lot of scintillations. So using the scintillation statistics with weather data, one can estimate the sensible heat flux. If you have the measurements of net radiation and ground heat flux, one can estimate the ET from it. So using that information, one can validate ET map that we derived from remote sensing. But nobody tested whether these instruments works or not, but they are being used everywhere. So we completed these two experiments in 2007 and 2008. At present, we are evaluating all the major models to see whether we can get a good ET map from these models. And also, we are testing at different spatial resolution to make sure that they don't break down at any spatial resolution. And also, we looked at the scintillometer data. Based on our study, we found that the accuracy may be about 86%. Also, we are looking at the desegregation of low-resolution thermal or ET maps to come up with the high-resolution maps. And as I mentioned earlier, we don't get a clear images all the time, so there will be a data gap. So we need some other way of filling this information because farmers need ET maps on a daily basis. So we are working with researchers in Meteorological Sciences Department in Texas Tech to fill that information because they have a different way of estimating sensible heat flux. So using those technologies, we think that we can fill that information.